depends on who you ask what they call it. So most people would probably call it basic science, meaning that it's fairly basic in terms of what the question is. I'm studying how the brain is built, but I would very much prefer to call it fundamental, which brings in another aspect to it, which means that actually further research can be built on top of it. It's like a foundation of a house. So I'm studying how the brain is put together so it can function in an environment that we live in for human beings. And despite the fact that I'm studying how the mouse brain is built for very obvious reasons, we do that. It's a technical difficulty that we are having to directly study the human brain in the resolution we need to study it in. Actually, I'm not interested in how the mouse brain is built. I'm interested in how the human brain is built. And I would really fancy taking a trip out of my comfort zone to find out what other people think about this. First of all, I don't believe in autistic mice either, so we agree on that. Okay, that's great. Secondly, I think it needs a whole lot of demystification. So people would call mice autistic, so they get funding. It doesn't actually mean they believe in that. So that's why I answered to one of the questions already, that it's the funding system that needs to be changed. So what mice can be is they can model little tiny parts of human behavior, but we can have much higher resolution looking at what's causing the particular sort of tiny fragment of human behavior in that mouse. And that way we can boil it down to the actual, okay, so how did it come about? And with mice, we can do it really in a spectacular fashion. So we can take mutations, for instance, that are known to be somehow linked to autism, as we know that there's quite a few cases where autism runs in the family. So that then is really useful. I would not call these mice autistic mice, but they might display certain behaviors which we know from the autistic people. And do not necessarily, we are not interested in the behavior that the mice display. We are interested in how did it come about in terms of one neuron talking to the other neuron. And we can do that in mice, but we cannot do that in humans. So I don't think there's such thing as autistic mice. That's my short answer after the long answer. Actually, my research is all about how many of green neurons do we have versus purple neurons. That's literally the color coding of our paper, which we did this way so that we would include everyone no matter whether they are colorblind or not, and that's not very common to pay attention to in the artistic part of the research world. So we tend to want to have really good figures because that's the way people judge a scientific publication, no matter the level. So the most sciencey people, they also judge based on this presentation aspect. Yet we never actually think about it as much as we should. So in many ways, this comes before the text comes, and the text is the one that contains the information in theory. So I'm very happy that I found this, so I can have my little green neurons, nerve cells from the brain, and try to think of a balance between these and the purple ones, which represents the cells in your brain. That if it was a dinner table discussion, the way your brain works, then the purple ones would be the ones that would encourage others to join in. And then the green guys would be the ones that tell others to shut up. And in a funny way, these are the ones that are more important for brain function, because if everyone just invites the other one to join in, you get no discussion, everyone's just shouting. So I find this really fascinating, this kind of analogy about our brain, that it's actually the shush cells that the ones that make it work. And not a lot of people know about this. So I would really like to put it on my piece of art, and I will probably have to stand next to it and tell every single person who shows up, because it's not obvious. So in a research context, I have never ever spoken to a single autistic person, and not because I was trying to actively avoid it, rather the opposite, but I just never get a chance to be exposed to these sort of opportunities, no matter how much I would like to. Now my solution to that was to organize this project. Through my actual social life, I've got 3 children, and the eldest one goes to a fully inclusive school. So we have autistic classmates there who I get to meet and speak to, and we have play dates together. And also my husband is a swimming teacher. So it's funny that once you have kids, your actual social circle outside of work is potentially including a lot more people, because it's your kids who bring people in, and they are far more open than we are to start chatting, and nobody thinks you're really odd if you are at the playground and start to randomly talk to a person just because your kids are sitting on swings next to each other. So in that context, I think kids are also awesome to bring people together, and you don't even need free food and portraits and all the rest of it. So that's my exposure to the autistic community, which is really far from enough. So I'm hoping that with this project, I will get more exposure, and hopefully other fundamental scientists will get more exposure too. That's what I will work really hard on to happen. So as I said before, my research is basically all about how these cells inside the brain, neurons, are born, how they are selected to go where they end up, and then how do they talk to one another, which is an interesting aspect here that in a way I'm listening in on the discussion of the neurons, but I'm lacking discussion with humans. It's really funny how, you know, neurons are better friends than humans, and it's easier to get them all in the same room because they are all enclosed in our skull. So I would like my research to go into more of a translational sort of direction, where still having a fundamental question, but with an outlook as to what it might contribute to. So I would be much more able to form questions and then have the impact section of my funding applications written in a way that it's not just going to be meaningful research, I get the data, but it will be successful research, meaning that I get the data that is required for the next steps to carry forward and to actually change people's lives through that. Because after all, that's what science is there for, to move the world forward and not just to keep it spinning. I think it definitely does need changing, and probably the best place to target would be the funders, those who fund the research. So currently the way at least fundamental research is funded is based on creating meaningful information at the end of it, not necessarily useful for the community that it might be meant for in the end. So they always try to weigh up the risks of not getting the results, which in our case and in most of the cases is data. Can you get the data? And then they often forget, so what? So what are you going to do with that data? What is it going to be good for? Is that the one that is the most primary need? And I think in many other disciplines, it's far easier to identify that need, because if we are talking about infectious diseases, is you need to stop the epidemic. It's a very clear endpoint, and no matter if you actually went there and asked the people, chances are that's what they want. But in many neuroscience-related disciplines, you need to involve the people who are affected by what you're trying to study, because it's a softer question. What do they actually need from the research? Well, I wish everyone had children. And on that front, the scientific community will probably do really badly, because it still seems to be a bit of a boundary to continue your research once you have your kids, time-wise and everything-wise. But then if these sort of occasions were more valued than simply writing on a piece of paper or pipetting liquid from one tube to the other, I think that's more of a mindset change. Then we might have, obviously that's a longer term change, but we might have more kids, and then we might be present in more playgrounds, and then you have much more opportunity to actually get people together this way, through kids, cats, dogs, no matter what they choose to own, plants. Yes. So that I think that would be a lovely idea to put forward, albeit it's a bit soft and like far-fetched. But yes, I think it's a great idea. I think that's the beauty of it, that in a way we will all become artists here in this project, because we are working with Mario together, using his guidance to create something that we find visually good or acceptable, and at the same time have open ideas around bigger questions. So it will bring us all to the same room, and it will bring us all to the same level to discuss an open question which affects all of us. So I feel that both people who are affected by the research and people who do the research, no matter at which end of the scale in terms of actual translation and clinic down to basic or fundamental, should feel like they are fully involved in both the planning and the carrying out of the research right up to the point of actually submitting the research to publication. Because after all, how else will we know what is required and which way we should go from the very beginning upright until the end? So that's how I feel involvement for everyone is better than having silent members who cannot contribute with their opinions, which might be actually very important to actually judge something as successful rather than meaningful. It might be meaningful but not successful, if you know what I mean. If that's not what the need was, then you succeeded in doing what you planned to do, but you did not ask the people what they wanted, so you're not going to be successful. I would like to ask them, what is their current view of the sort of science that I do? That's a kind of a personal question. If they feel like they are not informed enough, what's stopping them from being more informed so that I can make changes at my own level? And I would also like to ask a more global question as to what sort of research do they feel is important to them, and hopefully, yeah, by the end of the session, they would, and most of them probably wouldn't in the beginning, include basic research on how our brain is actually built and how does it function. So kind of expanding their horizons, that's my like hidden agenda behind, but also at the same time getting an answer as to what's stopping them from feeling like they could be fully involved with the research that I do as well. So I'm getting informed, they are getting informed, everyone's getting inspired together. So I'm a firm believer that art breaks down boundaries. And also I know for a fact, at least coming from my point of view, that staring yourself in the mirror is probably equally uncomfortable for anyone. And then drawing on your own portrait is again something really highly personal. And I think that this holds the key for bringing people together who are separated by these invisible boundaries, which seem to be there for whatever reason. In the case of fundamental neuroscience and clinical neuroscience, we even have a physical boundary of 20 minutes of a bus ride, and that can actually stop us from talking to one another. So I think that through art, we can get these two different groups of scientists, who are not so different after all, together with the autistic community also in there, both everyone feeling equally uncomfortable about their portrait hanging on the wall, and use that as a positive thing to then bring everyone to the same level and have a discussion which is fully open about the future of autism research. I'm basically completely avoiding looking into my own eyes and just trying to think about my personality and how I can reflect that in the background but not on my face. So I would by all means always choose to, I think, like look around the face rather than in straight in the eyes. It's interesting, slightly intimidating despite being in my own house. Well, maybe I am not neurotypical. I don't think there's such a thing as neurotypical, and I think the chances are, maybe apart from some very, very extrovert people, most of us are not very comfortable with looking ourselves in the eye 100%. Especially in this case, it's actually a portrait drawn by someone who I happen to know in person. So it also includes a fair bit of an element of, that's the way he sees me. So it's even like more difficult than if it was the mirror and it was a good day or a bad day and I would be just me and myself. In this case, it's me and Mario and myself. So yes, but I honestly don't think that there's one answer to this question, and I don't think it's something that would separate an autistic person from even if I was neurotypical. I don't think it would make much of a difference here. Probably we are equally uncomfortable with this. Most of us are. Yeah, I think 100% it would be very different. I would probably look the eyes first. Because then when I meet someone, that's the way I judge them. And the very first, very important impression for me is whether they appear kind or not. And if they appear kind, then I feel at ease much faster and open up much quicker. But that's what I know. I shouldn't be actually judging people based on their eyes, but if someone has many, many angry wrinkles and looks really grumpy, then I will feel a little bit more intimidated. But I would always, you know, give a second chance, because it might be that they're just having a really bad day on that day. So yeah, it's probably the opposite with other people. I would look the eye first. Connection is about having a conversation. And for me, these nerve cells, despite the fact that they communicate in a really mystical way for most of us, including me actually, because I'm not an electrophysiologist, but they use first chemical signals, which then translate into a membrane potential change, and then it gets very physicky, and I was never very good at physics, so I feel slightly uncomfortable about it. But ultimately, it's a discussion. At the most basic level, it's a discussion. Well, I think it depends on the preference of the people. So maybe we should have a consultation since we got everyone in the same room. And I think that's a really good start. So we could actually discuss what other ways people think we could create conversation that does not involve all of us getting in the same room. Because let's face it, the distance might be more than 20 minutes. There might not be enough money for food. And we might not have portraits hanging on the wall. But even without these, we should be able to have discussions and conversation. But for that, we do not necessarily have to be in the same room. I think it's ideal to be in the same room, but it's not always feasible, and that shouldn't stop us from talking.